So, parading your way next on the stream of free radio at freakradio.org, it's Bathrop Spears Broadsides, of course, the June 23rd, 2022 edition. We're talking 2 hours of lots of Keith McHenry and some of Alicia Cool and some of some other folks, and then, of course, lots of me. But you probably already knew that before you started if you've been to this place before. So enjoy yourselves or get ready to deal with whatever you have to deal with, and we will proceed.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's begin with a fairly optimistic story, or gives me a little bit of optimism. Not a lot. It's a story from yesterday's Sentinel, a paper I often call the Scent Anal, because of the odor it emits. It's called, well, the headline is Chicago PD Unveils Long-Awaited Foot Pursuit Policy. Law enforcement, this is an AP article. Chicago police officers will no longer be allowed to chase people on foot simply because they run away or they've committed minor offenses, the department said Tuesday, more than a year after two foot pursuits ended with officers fatally shooting a 13-year-old boy and a 22-year-old man. The new policy adheres closely to a draft policy put in place after those shootings and gives the department something it has never had, permanent rules about which officers can and can't engage in an activity that can endanger themselves, those they're chasing, and bystanders. Chicago Police Superintendent David Brown said he expects the new policy will make the officers and the public safer, as has happened in other cities with similar policies. The impact on crime has been studied, and we can look back at what has made officers safer, has made communities safer for over a decade, he told reporters at a press briefing on the policy, which he expects to be in place by the end of the summer after all officers receive training. Under the policy, officers may give chase if they believe a person is committing or is about to commit a felony, a Class A misdemeanor such as domestic battery, or a serious traffic offense that could risk injuring others, such as drunken driving or street racing. Officers won't be allowed to chase people on foot if they suspect them of minor offenses, such as parking violations, driving on suspended licenses, or drinking alcohol in public. But they will still have discretion to chase people who they've determined are committing or about to commit crimes that pose, quote, an obvious threat to any person. Perhaps most significant, the policy makes clear that the days of officers giving chase just because someone tries to avoid them are over. People may avoid contact with a member for many reasons other than involvement in criminal activity, the policy states. The names of 13-year-old Adam Toledo and 22-year-old Anthony Alvarez, who were armed when they ran from the police in separate March 2021 pursuits, are not mentioned in the news release announcing the policy or the policy itself, but those pursuits, particularly those of Alvarez, cast a shadow over the policy. Mayor Lori Lightfoot demanded that the department create an interim policy after the shootings, and the county's top prosecutor harshly criticized police over the Alvarez pursuit. It also appears the police department took pains to prohibit just that kind of foot chase. Under the policy, the chase of Alvarez would have apparently not have been allowed for two key reasons. First, when police chased him for a traffic violation, they knew who he was and where he lived. Cook County State Attorney's Kim Fox told reporters in March when she announced that the officers involved in the two shootings wouldn't be charged. Second, officers are no longer allowed to chase on foot people who are suspected of the kind of minor offense that led to the chase. The policy includes a number of circumstances in which an officer must call off a chase, including a requirement that the pursuit must end if a third party is injured and needs immediate medical attention that can't be provided by anyone else. If officers realize they do not know exactly where they are, which is possible in a chaotic situation in which they are running through alleys and between houses, they must stop. Of course, it doesn't mention that either of these two cops who killed these two people face any kind of disciplinary activity, were fired, much less prosecuted for what they did. Maybe some of that happened, maybe it didn't. I may take a quick look right now. So a quick look on Wikipedia, the so-called free encyclopedia, says on March 31st, 2021, Anthony Alvarez, a 22-year-old Latino man, was shot and killed by a Chicago PD officer in the Portage Park neighborhood on the north side of Chicago. Police body camera footage of Alvarez's death was released on April 28th, I think that's a year later, showing Alvarez being shot in the back while fleeing from police with a firearm in his hand. The footage of Alvarez's death was the third high-profile release of footage showing police killing a young Latino in the month of April 2021, following Adam Toledo and Mario Gonzalez. I guess Toledo was the 13-year-old. Anthony Alvarez was a 22-year-old Latino man from Chicago. He was a father. Evan Solano was a Latino who was identified as the officer who shot Alvarez, an officer for the Chicago Police Department since 2015. The Civilian Office of Police Accountability launched an investigation into the incident. Spokesperson for the organization recommended that Solano should be, quote, relieved of police powers during the pendency of this investigation. The Cook County State's Attorney's Office announced on March 15, 2022, that Solano and his partner created the conditions which necessitated the use of deadly force, but that the office would not file charges in the shooting. In body camera footage of Alvarez's death, Solano could be seen pursuing Alvarez on Laramie Avenue after what Mayor Lightfoot described as a minor traffic violation. At the intersection of Laramie and Eddy, a gun is visible in Alvarez's hand. Solano shouted, "Drop the gun! Drop the gun!" before immediately firing five shots in quick succession at Alvarez's back. Alvarez asks, "Why are you shooting me?" to which Solano replies, "Because you had a gun." Alvarez was later pronounced dead at the hospital. On May 1st, about 100 people marched through Portage Park in Chicago from West Irving Park Road and North Central Avenue to the site of Alvarez's death. Alvarez's family was amongst the protesters. His daughter held a sign reading, "I miss my daddy." The protesters chanted, "Hands up, don't shoot. If Anthony don't get no justice, then they don't get no peace." Activists stated, "We want that cop charged. We want the police defunded and that money put back into the communities." U.S. House Representative Jesus Shuey Garcia wrote on Twitter, "Whether it's a 13-year-old or a 22-year-old, police encounters shouldn't end in death. The killings of Adam Toledo and Anthony Alvarez aren't isolated, rather the tip of an iceberg revealing a system tilted against black and brown communities. Whatever the circumstances, the killings must end." Illinois State Representative Will Guzzardi said, "There's nothing you can do. No record on your background, no affiliations, no history, nothing you can do to deserve being shot in the back while you run. Let me repeat that. There is nothing Anthony could have done to deserve the fate that befell him. This is not an indictment of any bad apples, but rather of the very role that we have given to law enforcement, a role they didn't ask for and that they don't want, and a role that leads inexorably to the kind of tragedy that we mourn yet again today. And I would dispute that it's not a role they didn't ask for and they didn't want, because I suspect the laws in Illinois are similar to the laws in California protecting the police and created at the instigation of the police officers' union. So I think they are responsible. But that's my offhand impression. Aftermath. In the aftermath of both Alvarez and Toledo shootings, Mayor Lori Lightfoot and the Chicago Police Superintendent Brown said that changes to the city's foot pursuit policy would be in place by the end of the summer of 2021. But apparently it's taken to the summer of 2022. The city's practice has been under scrutiny since 2017, when a Department of Justice report called foot pursuits inherently dangerous because officers can experience fatigue or adrenaline, which can compromise their ability to make sound judgments or use less force as the threat diminishes. The city's police force is currently under a federal consent decree, which requires the department to make reforms to its policing practices. In 2020, a civil rights lawsuit forced Chicago to retrain its officers on foot pursuit tactics, but the court-mandated independent monitoring team has warned that the officers don't have the requisite buy-in on the reforms because, quote, there is a sense that these concepts go against the culture of the organization. And for those who want to follow this further, there are lists of people killed by law enforcement by Wikipedia, both on duty and off duty. Congress, according to this article, instructed the Attorney General in 1994 to compile and publish annual statistics on police use of excessive force. This was never carried out, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation does not collect these data. The average annual number of justifiable homicides alone was previously estimated to be nearly 400. Updated estimates from the Bureau of Justice Statistics released in 2015 estimate the number to be around 930 per year, or 1,240 if assuming that non-reporting local agencies kill people at the same rate as reporting agencies. A 2019 study by Esposito, Lee, and Edwards states that police killings are a leading cause of death for men aged 25 to 29, 1.8 per 100,000, trailing causes such as accidental death, suicide, and other homicides. So they may be leading, but it doesn't look like they're leading that many. Accidental death is 76.6, suicide is 26.7, and other homicides are 22.0, whereas the police weigh in at only 1.8. So they are not a major killer compared with the total number of homicides. But then again, I guess there aren't that many policemen. And if you consider policemen and contacts, it might be a different kind of figure. And there's also one additional fact. Lancet's study notes death certificates do not require coroners to list whether the police were involved in the death, which may contribute to some disparity in the figure. So now let's throw in a little foreign policy here. Here's something from the Scott Horton Show. Horton does a thing called the antiwar.org website. It's a libertarian website for all of you anti-socialists. But he does, in my view, good foreign policy analysis, or at least I agree with him, so maybe that says the story. He has on, at this particular point, a guy called Douglas McGregor, and the topic is on the lies getting Ukrainians killed. Why is this important on homeless issues? Well, first of all, the Ukrainian war is creating huge numbers of homeless folks, probably more than any recent war has. And then secondly, the danger of all of us not just losing our homes, but losing our world because of the nuclear escalation that is likely to happen very quickly and with genocidal, you might even say not just speciesicidal, but effects that kill, I don't know, all animal life on the planet because of the nuclear winter situation. That may be the most extreme scenario, but certainly human life, people would essentially starve to death because of the smoke coverings that would happen with all the fires that happened as a consequence of the nuclear winter, according to scenarios. Admittedly, it's never been experimentally done as far as we don't have a planet to destroy to check it out. But anyway, here's Scott Horton interviewing Scott McGregor.
You guys on the line, I've got retired U.S. Army Colonel Douglas McGregor. And you know what? I was looking at his Amazon page today. An extremely prolific writer here. The Margin of Victory, Five Battles That Changed the Face of Modern War, Breaking the Phalanx, A New Design for Land Power in the 21st Century, Transformation Under Fire, which has an F-35 on the front. That must be hilarious. And, of course, Warrior's Rage, The Great Tank Battle of 73 Easting, about his role in Iraq War I. And, yeah, good stuff. And then here he is, writing for the American Conservative again. I swear, I checked this morning. Is there a new article at TAC? Nope. And then just before we went on the air, you sent me this. When the Lies Come Home, at the American Conservative Magazine. Welcome back to the show, Doug. How you doing?
Great, great.
Which lies are these you're referring to here?
Well, all of the lies connected with this tragic Ukrainian war. I mean, essentially, we have not told the truth. And when I say we, I'm talking about Washington, the Washington community, virtually everybody in it. They haven't bothered to tell the American people how we worked tirelessly to essentially push the Russians into a corner from which they could not escape. And how we ignored everything that the Russians said, everything they requested, to the point where an intervention by the Russians militarily in eastern Ukraine was seen as unavoidable by Moscow for reasons of its own national security. And then you add to that the lies that have been perpetrated ever since this war began at the end of February that are just ridiculous, portraying the Ukrainians as some sort of victorious army marching to victory every other week, the Russians as hopeless, bungling incompetents who can't possibly do anything. So here we sit. We've obviously sabotaged every conceivable negotiation that took place and essentially told our friends in Kiev, you know, fight on to victory. We'll supply you with anything you need. And I think behind the scenes, they may have even made some promises. I don't know, that we would actively intervene in this thing, which is probably one of the reasons why the Ukrainians kept on fighting. But the truth is, from the very beginning, the Ukrainians were pushed onto the defensive. And a lot of people don't understand, you know, if you move into a defensive position right at the outset, essentially move into cities in urban centers, try to defend yourself from there, you're not going to win anything. I mean, Bonaparte used to say the army that remains within its fortifications is beaten. Well, that's still true today. Ukrainians have never launched any major offensives. They've had local counterattacks by commanders, but nothing significant on the operational level. So there's been no maneuver. The Russians have then changed their modus operandi to adapt to what the Ukrainians did. And unfortunately, the Ukrainians have given them an opportunity to grind them and pulverize them into oblivion, which is what the Russians are doing. In the meantime, we continue to lie about it, keep telling everybody, oh, no, things are really great. The Russians are finished. The Russians are this. The Russians are that. The point now is that it appears that President Biden and his team, along with a lot of people on the Hill from both parties, want desperately to keep this thing going so that even though the war is effectively lost and the Russians now control everything that's really valuable or of any utility to the Ukrainians in eastern Ukraine, They want to turn Western Ukraine into a base of operations for future attacks on Russia. So I guess they want endless war in the region, which is extremely dangerous to Europe. It's dangerous to us. It's unnecessary. It doesn't make any sense.
All right. So a few things there, but let's stick with the battlefield and what's happening in the actual war, because as you're saying here, there are these huge competing narratives about just how badly either side is losing here. I think one of the keys in your article is you say here that the Russians' strategy, at least for now and in recent weeks, has been just destroying Ukrainian forces, not necessarily, taking more and more land all the time. They'll get to that once the forces have been destroyed, I guess. But that, in a way, helps feed the narrative that, oh, look, Ukraine is winning because the Russians withdrew from Kharkiv, for example. And that was seen as a big strategic win for the Ukrainian side, I guess. But I am, and I admit, too, I've been working on a book, and so I'm a bit behind on the news. But I have read from time to time these stories about how essentially the Russian war is simply just massive artillery, just more or less carpet bombing with artillery and moving slowly and taking, whatever positions they need to. So
I think that's I think that's misleading. I think we have to understand that, yes, the initial focus was the destruction of Ukrainian forces. Ukrainians had massed forces in front of these two breakaway republics. It looked like they were going to launch an offensive. In fact, the Russians say they have copies of plans for exactly that, with a follow-on offensive to drive the Russians out of Crimea. Complete lunacy in my judgment, but that's what the Ukrainians apparently thought. So they attacked before they were organized to do what they wanted to do, that is, attack the Ukrainians. And the Russians have now recognized that they cannot leave Ukraine, that whatever they do, if they leave eastern Ukraine, the Ukrainians will reassert themselves as they did in the past and turn it into a base for attack against Russia. So the Russians have said, fine, we've abandoned our initial goals. The initial goals, as I'm sure your viewers remember, neutrality for Ukraine. In other words, not NATO membership. Number two, autonomy for the two republics where the population is Russian, wants to speak Russian. Treat Russians in general inside eastern Ukraine, not as second-class citizens, but as equal citizens with equal rights. And then finally recognize the legitimacy of Crimea and its ownership by Russia. Those were the initial goals. They're gone. It's finished. And what they've decided to do now, and they've already begun, by the way, is to firmly consolidate control of most of eastern Ukraine. They withdrew forces from Kharkov, not because they were beaten or forced out, but because they concluded that they needed those forces elsewhere to get the job done down in what we call the Donbas, this huge area down in southeastern Ukraine, where most of the country's industrial mineral resources are located, natural gas fields, oil, and so forth. That's underway. The Ukrainian army is effectively destroyed. About 80% of it no longer exists. Only about 20% of it is left. So what the Russians are now dealing with are large numbers of reservists who really don't want to be thrown into this buzzsaw. And they're trying to plug gaps and hold on to whatever they can. But the truth is that Russia now controls 75 to 80% of anything that's worth having in Ukraine, the industrial area, the mines, the mineral resources, oil, gas, and so forth. And the Russian population is there, and they have told the Russian population, we are going to stay. So now they're getting enormous cooperation and support from the Russians who live there, because initially they said they'd come in and then leave. And the average Russian living in eastern Ukraine says, well, that's fine. As soon as you leave, the Ukrainian secret police shows up, shoots me in the back of the head and kills my family. So I'm not going to help you. So that's gone now. They're very definitely going to stay. There will be no negotiation in terms of territory that the Russians already hold and the territory they will eventually capture, because I think we're going to see them go back into Kharkov, take that. It's a Russian-speaking city, always has been. And also Odessa. Both Odessa and Kharkov are Russian cities, historically, culturally, ethnically. So the Russians will do that. Now, at that point, I think the Russians will be through. They're not interested in Western Ukraine. They don't want Ukrainians inside Russia. They know what goes on in Western Ukraine. They know the hatred for the Russians that exists there that goes back long before the Second World War. So now the question is, how do we end this fighting? Because the last thing we want to do or should want to do is turn Western Ukraine into a sort of permanent target practice area for the Russians. And that effectively is what will happen if we don't intervene to stop this. And I don't see any evidence that Washington wants to stop it. So that means the Europeans are the ones that are going to have to come forward, because I don't think any of you Europeans, even the Poles, as utterly, incurably anti-Russian as they may be, I don't think they want a permanent war between Russia and themselves in Western Ukraine. Mm-hmm. I don't think the Europeans want to be dragged into a larger regional war between the United States and Russia. So as a result, I think we're going to watch this NATO business really unravel in the near future. And if you look at the economic conditions in Germany, especially, and let's be frank, Germany is the EU. Germany, frankly, is also, for all intents and purposes, NATO. If you take Germany out of the equation, everything falls apart, and the German economy is in ruins. Somebody said to me the other day, and I think this is probably accurate, that we, with our sanctions against Russia and imposing on Germany to support these sanctions, have done more damage to the German economy in the last year, or I guess we should say, what, last 6-8 months, than Bomber Harris and the Royal Air Force did during World War II. That's not an overstatement. The shelves are empty in many German stores. They can't get the things that they're normally accustomed to getting, sunflower, seed oil, many of the foodstuffs for bread and so forth that they're accustomed to. And Germans have a very high standard of living. This standard of living is falling. And then, of course, on top of that, they have an enormous refugee problem. Now, in addition to 1 million Muslims, they've got large numbers of Ukrainians coming in. The crime rate continues to climb in all of those areas. The Germans are not happy. And I think Olaf Scholz, has handled things very, very badly. He could have been a source of communication and support between us and Russia to end this thing. And instead, he's joined the Biden Titanic, as I call it. And then, of course, you also have our economic situation at home. And, Scott, I don't need to tell you about that. I mean, Americans understand the inflation problem, and I point that out in the article. So I don't see this ending well for us. And Russia is, frankly, not suffering in the ways that the people that imposed the sanctions hoped.
Yeah.
Not to be rude, but let's take a little musical aside from this so we can calm down and contemplate nuclear holocaust and the escalating war with a more of a calm approach. And this is another of these Dave Lippmann songs called Fixin' to Die Rag, Trump style. And I don't like Democratic Party hackery where Trump gets blamed for everything the Democrats fucked up on, too. But I like this song, so I'm going to let you hear it. But here are the lyrics first so you can actually follow some of it. Well, come on, everyone at home or work. MAGA man done gone berserk. He thinks you cure corona with bleach and sunscreen. That's why we're all getting COVID-19. Why, he won't wear a mask, do you gotta ask? Oh, he's totally up to the task. Now, come on, Wall Street, don't be slow. Bet on the crash, then buy it low. There's plenty good money to be made in viral marketing to folks afraid. Stable genius knew all along, too bad everything he knew was wrong. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we dying for? Don't ask me, I don't really know. Ask P.T. Trumpum, it's his shit show. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no need to test the poor, it's just another common cold. Well, all you folks in our great GOP think government keeps you from being free, but I know you're going to scream holy heck if you don't get your stimulus check. $1,200 for all the Joe six-packs, and for the rest of them, stock buybacks. Now, all of us don't get equal hell, like the black and the brown don't live so well. A mob of MAGA persuasion conducted a statehouse invasion. Though heavily armed, they parted unharmed. That's how you know they're Caucasian. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we dying for? Don't ask me, I don't really know. Ask President Nero, it's his shit show. And it's 5, 6, 7, come on and feel the hate. Oh, ladies are someone else's mom, so let them be real gone. We shelter in place, they deliver our food, while Amazon workers are totally screwed. We can order TP with a couple clicks, and if that gets old, there's always Netflix. Meanwhile, prisoners and immigrants be the first to come home in a box. Now you know who started it, them Chinese, and some Mexican rapists, oh please don't sneeze. WHO gets no more dough. They're the only world. They're only the world. What do they know? But I can't wait for the courtroom drama when we blame it all on Obama. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we dying for? Don't ask me. I don't really know. Ask Jared. It's his shit show. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. You want PPE? Don't look at me. That's totally up to the states. Anyway, the fix is in. It's hydrochloroquine. The fact that some of this proved to be true rather than false in terms of different kinds of assistance for treatment for COVID-19 or the seriousness of COVID-19. Let's just hear the song anyway and try to enjoy the rhythm.
Berserk. He thinks she took Corona with bleach and sunscreen. That's why we're all getting COVID-19. While he won't wear a mask, you gotta ask. Well, he's totally up to the task. Now come on Wall Street, don't be slow. Bet on a crash and buy it up low. There's plenty of good money to be made. In viral marketing, the folks afraid. Sable genius knew all along. Too bad everything he knew was wrong. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we dying for? Don't ask me, I don't really know. Ask P.T. Trumpet, it's his shit show. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up pearly gates. Well, ain't no need to test the poor. It's just another common cold. Well, all you folks in the great GOP think government keeps you from being free. But I know you're gonna scream holy heck if you don't get your stimulus check. $1,200 for all the Jill six packs, and for the rest, stock buyback. Now all of us don't get equal hell, like the black and the brown and don't live so well. A mob of the MAGA persuasion conducted a state house invasion. Though heavily armed, they parted unharmed, and that's how you know they're Caucasian. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we dying for? Don't ask me, I don't really know. Ask President Nero, it's his shit show. And it's 5, 6, 7. Come on and feel the hate. Old ladies are someone else's mom, so let them be real gone. We shelter in place and deliver our food, while Amazon workers are totally screwed. We can order TP with a couple of clicks. That gets old as always Netflix. Meanwhile, prisoners and immigrants be the first to come home in a box. Now you know who started it, them Chinese and some Mexican rapists. Please don't sneeze. WHO gets no more dough. They're only the world. What do they know? But I can't wait for the courtroom drama when we blame it all on Obama. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we dying for? Don't ask me, I don't really know. Ask Jared, it's his shit show. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. You want PPE? Don't look at me. That's totally up to the states. Anyway, the fix is in. It's hydroxychloroquine.
And now back to Douglas McGregor on the Scott Horton Show.
Germans have a very high standard of living. This standard of living is falling. And then, of course, on top of that, they have an enormous refugee problem. Now, in addition to 1 million Muslims, they've got large numbers of Ukrainians coming in. The crime rate continues to climb in all of those areas. The Germans are not happy. And I think Olaf Scholz, handled things very, very badly. He could have been a source of communication and support between us and Russia to end this thing. And instead, he's joined the Biden Titanic, as I call it. And then, of course, you also have our economic situation at home. And, Scott, I don't need to tell you about that. I mean, Americans understand the inflation problem, and I point that out in the article. So I don't see this ending well for us. And Russia is, frankly, not suffering in the ways that the people that imposed the sanctions hoped. Yeah. Russia's economy is not being destroyed. I'm sorry, it's not happening. In fact, foreign investment is pouring into Russia right now.
Yeah, well, and just capital flowing in the form of high prices for petroleum, and you know they're hydrocarbon exporters, and so as all the sanctions and all the dislocations help spike the price of oil. That's just higher revenues for them. So the whole thing's backfiring. And in fact, the press had it that the Biden officials are complaining about this too. That, oh, geez, it's not working how we meant it to work. Imagine that, a government program. But I think,
but Scott, yeah, you know something that all of your viewers need to understand, and Americans today don't have an historical memory for this kind of thing. But I cannot imagine at the height of the Cold War, any president of the United States who confronted something like this, who would not have immediately intervened and said, let's arrange a ceasefire. Let's hold a conference. Let's come to some sort of arrangement, sort this out. It's inconceivable to me that a president of the United States and his administration, like this one, would do everything in his power to worsen the situation,
right,
not just to keep this going and sacrifice. We think the Ukrainians have lost at least 60,000 dead fighting the Russians, but to push it further on the assumption that somehow or another this benefits us, benefits Western Europe, benefits Russia. None of it does. It's all disastrous. I never thought I'd live to see something like this, Scott.
Well, you know, I mean, we have the historical precedent there with the uprisings in Hungary and Czechoslovakia and under Ike and under LBJ, and the crushing of Polish solidarity under Ronald Reagan. And the American president's answers then were, sorry, pal, you're too far east to be our problem. We draw the line halfway across Germany, and that's it. It's the Soviet sphere of influence, and we don't like it, but it is what it is. Now we're 1,200 miles east of there, fighting right on their border.
Well, that's right.
Pretty nuts.
Again, how many times do we have to explain to people how we would react to a large foreign military presence in Mexico, army equipping and training the Mexicans to fight us?
Well, yeah, exactly. Now, as far as getting back to Germany here, I think a big part of the problem, right, is that their former strongman, Angela Merkel, is gone. And she was the chancellor for, what, 16 years or something? She had the courage at least to stand up to Obama and, you know, on Minsk II and things like that. But part of our problem, I think, right, is we got the new guy. He just got here. And so he's very much under pressure and the sway of the U.S. and doesn't have the kind of political capital that she had built up to.
Well, perhaps I'm not nearly as enthusiastic about Merkel as you are, and I think.
Well, I'm not. I'm not enthusiastic. I just mean she had the strength in her position to have a will of her own in a way that seems to be somewhat different.
Well, again, you know, my complaint about the Europeans is very straightforward. As long as we're bombing or destroying countries in the quote-unquote developing world remote from Europe, they may not have liked what we were doing, but they didn't care. In other words, they were happy to make themselves dependent upon us for defense as long as that dependency did not directly affect their security. And otherwise, what I'm trying to say is that the idea that we would create, push forward, sustain, and perpetuate a war in Ukraine against Russia is something that nobody in Europe inside NATO really bargained for. This is not a war where we are throwing Russian forces back from the border of NATO. This is not a war that was started against us by Russia. This is an entirely different situation. And the Europeans are beginning to figure all of this out. And they're beginning to say, look, We didn't sign on to become satellites of the United States so that we too could be dragged into war, have our economies destroyed, our standard of living ruined, and our national security jeopardized. So I really think Germany is important because Germany is the once and future king economically, politically of Europe. And the Germans are reaching the boiling point over there. I don't think Olaf Scholz's government is going to last very long. And as far as Merkel was concerned, she was really, for the most part, on easy street. The one thing she did for which the Germans will never forgive her is bring in a million Muslim refugees that they absolutely did not want and would like to go home. I mean, the tension in Germany between the Muslim refugees and the population is so thick right now, you could cut it with a knife. So there's real problems, but Merkel skated, got out just in the last minutes before things really fell apart. And we haven't even, we can't even waste time talking about the German bank, the Deutsche Bank, which is effectively the European Central Bank for all intents and purposes. That place is a disaster. They've never come clean on the enormous amounts of money that had to be spent on reunification, specifically the billions and billions of marks that had to be paid out to the Russians. They've got a lot off the balance sheet that they don't talk about, similar to what we have with the Fed. So there are real vulnerabilities and fragilities in Europe right now because of Germany.
Yep. Well, and of course, they had severe lockdown policies, forced their self-inflicted depression, and then bailed it out with all this paper money and inflation just like we did.
Yep.
So they're facing the consequences. All this is coming just on the heels of that. So now let me ask you about this. I met a man in Reno who, he was one of your guys, an Army tank guy, but in Iraq War II. And he was telling me that these new long-range artillery pieces, or maybe it was a rocket system that they're talking about sending over there, that these things are they can take out a city block, essentially. These are this is a real escalation, and especially there's a real question of the range on these weapons and whether the Ukrainian military could attack with them inside Russia and to devastating effect. And he seemed to be really worried that, man, when they're talking about sending these things over there, to him it seemed like a whole other level of escalation of the war, you know, in a really meaningful way. What do you think about that?
We're only sending 4 launchers at this point in time. Originally, we said we'd send 1, and they upped it to 4. If you look at those launchers and the number of rockets, it's pitiful. The kind of devastation he's talking about would take several platoons, batteries, battalions. And I can tell you that the MLRS, compared with Russian rocket artillery systems, let's put it this way, the Russians are hurling Volkswagens downrange. We're hurling golf balls. So while our system is very accurate, and is going to be limited to 50 kilometers, roughly. I guess you could go up to 60, but the long range, the 200-mile range or 180 kilometers and so forth, no, we're not going to provide those rockets to them because we don't want them to attack Russian territory with those weapons. The other thing is, remember, you've got hundreds of miles that you've got to cover. The soldiers that have been trained to use this are only now just reaching the point where they could conceivably operate the equipment. It takes on average a minimum of 5 weeks to train people to operate the rocket artillery system that we have. Then you've got to move that system hundreds of miles to the east and position it so that it can find and destroy Russian positions. Well, the problem, Scott, right now is that the terrain that we're talking about is flat and open. This is the Ukrainian steppe. I mean, it's a wonderful place from the standpoint of growing food, but there's no place to hide. It's why these areas in the world were dominated for centuries by cavalry and are now dominated largely by tank fire and artillery, long-range precision-guided missiles. These things are impossible to avoid in this vast open area, and the Ukrainians don't have the air and missile defense to protect these systems. So I don't think these are going to have much of an impact at all. I think they are likely to be destroyed very early once they come within range of any Russian forces.
Hang on just one second. Hey, y'all, the audiobook of my book, Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism, is finally done. Yes, of course, read by me. It's available at Audible, Amazon, Apple Books, and soon on Google Play and whatever other options there are out there. It's my history of America's war on terrorism from 1979 through today. Give it a listen and see if you agree. It's time to just come home. Enough Already. Time to End the War on Terrorism. The audiobook. Hey guys, I've had a lot of great webmasters over the years, but the team at expanddesigns.com have by far been the most competent and reliable. Harley Abbott and his team have made great sites for the show and the Institute, and they keep them running well, suggesting and making improvements all along. Make a deal with expanddesigns.com for your new business or news site. They will take care of you. Use the promo code Scott and save $500. That's expanddesigns.com. Hey guys, Scott Horton here for Listen and Think Libertarian Audiobooks. As you may know, the audiobook of my new book, Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism, is finally out. It's co-produced by our longtime friends at Listen and Think Libertarian Audiobooks. For many years now, Derek Sheriff over there at Listen and Think has offered lifetime subscriptions to anyone who donates $100 or more to The Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate or to the Libertarian Institute at libertarianinstitute.org/donate. And they've got a bunch of great titles, including Inside Syria by the late, great Rhys Ehrlich. That's listenandthink.com. And can you give us an update on the Harpoon and Trident missiles that they say they're sending for anti-Russian ship maneuvers there in the Black Sea?
Well, the Harpoon is a different animal. We actually became very concerned about it because you would launch a Harpoon missile beyond the horizon at sea, but you were never completely certain that the Harpoon would hit the target that you had originally designed to destroy. In other words, you could launch it. Once it got out of sight, it could hit almost anything. And so we recoiled from its use. I don't know anything about the Trident. I mean, I can't imagine Trident missiles being given to anybody for use anywhere, because those are potentially nuclear missiles. Not that the Ukrainians have any warheads, but I just don't see that happening. Look, the problem in the Black Sea right now is that the Black Sea is a puddle. It's not a big place. So even the Russian Navy chafes at having to operate there. So systems ashore can defend against naval forces very effectively if the naval force comes within range. And I think that the Ukrainians have demonstrated that. But I would expect that the Ukrainian coast that remains will be in Russian hands over the next couple of months. So I don't think these weapon systems are going to make much difference. The problem that we as Americans have is that we always are in a hunt, and I'm not saying we as the nation, I guess I should say many of the flag officers, are always looking for some silver bullet weapon that they hope and pray is going to dramatically change the outcome on the battlefield. Short of a nuclear strike, that kind of weapon doesn't exist. And what works well and what succeeds ultimately, what you're seeing with the Russians right now, are all the arms, tanks, artillery, infantry, linked to overhead surveillance, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance platforms, unmanned, manned. Those links to these precision systems are devastating to any force on the ground. And that's really what's happening. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. In fact, I think the Ukrainians are hanging on by their teeth right now, and they will shortly be out of business.
All right. Now, can you address for us a bit the controversy about the grain shipments and who's mining what and who's preventing grain from getting out, especially to the poorest people in the global south?
Sure. I think the first thing we need to understand is that the Turks stepped forward, for good or bad, and offered the Ukrainians and the Russians a deal under which they would help the Ukrainians demine the harbors. Now, this is very important because most Americans are not being told about this. The port of Odessa and the ports that neighbor it, that entire coastline is mined, not by the Russians, by the Ukrainians. It was mined to keep the Russians out, which makes perfect sense. As soon as you mine the waters approaching any area where you might land troops, you can call off any amphibious assault. This is one of the reasons why people have been saying for decades, why are we spending all this money on amphibious assault when we know that any place that counts is going to be mined? So the first thing is the Turks would go in and demine. And the Ukrainians have been lukewarm on that proposition. The second is that once it was demined, the Turks would escort Ukrainian ships out of those ports so that they could reach the Black Sea and move through the strait past Istanbul and move into the Mediterranean. Now, the Russians have said, yes, we'll support that. The Russians are not fools. They know that the world needs grain. The Russians have also suggested to the Ukrainians that they put them on rail, that is the grain stocks, and move them to neighboring countries, move through Romania and Bulgaria to other ports on the Mediterranean. Ukrainians aren't really in control of everything anymore, and there are other agendas at work in Kiev. And so Kiev has not really stepped up and agreed to do what the Turks have suggested. But everyone is pointing the finger at the Russians as the problem. But the Russians are not really blocking anything. The place is mined.
Although the longer the war continues, the longer all Ukrainian agriculture is disrupted, right? I mean, the seasons come and go. We only have so much time to get the seeds in the ground and get them ready for growing and harvesting in a few months from now.
Well, Scott, that's another matter that no one in Washington bothered to sit down and consider before we decided to do what we've done.
Yeah, well, why would they?
Well, you know, this is the thing. It's the whole thing is a disaster because when we embarked on this proposition that we should build up Ukraine into this giant military threat to Russia, and we have banked heavily on the Cold War hangover that treats anything that comes out of Russia as evil and bad, and we've done everything we could to demonize Putin and his government, we thought that we were sort of preparing the ground for Ukrainian success. What we did is we paved the road to Ukraine's destruction. I read the other day that 75 to 80% of all of Ukraine's gross national product comes out of the area the Russians are now occupying. Gosh, what a surprise.
Yeah, Mearsheimer said in 2014 in the pages of Foreign Affairs and on this show and in a speech that he gave right after that too, that I'm pretty sure the exact phrase he used in all three cases was America's leading Ukraine down the primrose path. And they are going to get wrecked. And even implied in that whole thing was nobody thought we were really going to come to their rescue. We're just telling them, yeah, you go and tell the Russians, what are you going to do about it to their face and see what happens. And then we'll just sit back and watch and laugh. And then I guess some of our more crooked corporations can cash in and we'll just have a war.
Well, I think there was always an interest in somehow or another ruining Russia. Bringing down Putin's government so that we could go back in and essentially rape Russia and its resources, which is effectively what happened in the 1990s. And that's what brought forth Putin. He and other Russian nationalists were tired of seeing their country exploited and ultimately destroyed by people pouring in from the West trying to take advantage of Russia's weakness. Yep. So, yeah, Mearsheimer was always right. And no one wanted to listen. I was castigated by the Hill because I had advocated in 2014 a plebiscite. You know, people talk about democracy in this town all the time. And as soon as you suggest that people should be allowed to vote and decide whether or not they want to live in Russia or they want to live in Ukraine, they're not allowed to do that. Yeah. And so we took the position that the borders are fixed. Well, borders have never been fixed in Europe for very long. And certainly not in the area that we're talking about. Those borders have changed many, many times over the last 300, 400, 500 years.
Well, and it's pretty clear, isn't it, that, I mean, Putin's position was, I really don't want the Donbass, but I want you to respect Minsk, too, and stop bombing them.
Oh, absolutely. The Minsk agreements were always a fraud, sadly. The Germans and the French tried, but not with all the energy at their disposal, very half-heartedly to push the Ukrainians into implementation. There were problems with the Minsk Accords. I don't think anybody disputes that. But it was very obvious to the Russians that the Ukrainians had no intention of ever fulfilling the expectations of those accords.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to what you said about just how dangerous this is and kind of how crazy it is. And we're having this conversation halfway through June right now, almost unbelievably. This war has continued all this time, and it was never the priority. They didn't even pretend that their priority was to try to negotiate a ceasefire and put an end to the danger here, only to escalate it. And, you know, there was this piece in NBC, I think it was, where this doesn't sound true, but it sounds important that they're telling this lie. And the lie is that Biden got really angry and castigated Blinken and Austin for their expansive statements about America's goals against Russia here, and that they didn't want that. So that seemed like, you know, possibly a bit of a climb down. But they say in the same article, quote, we are planning for a long war. Mm-hmm. And so, again, no emphasis whatsoever on negotiation. You know, they're clearly trying to drag this thing out. But I wonder, you know, from your perspective, how does this compare to you if I brought up, say, you know, early Reagan years and a lot of nuclear brinksmanship in Europe, or the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, or the height of the H-bomb testing back and forth in the 1950s, or, you know, some kind of comparison about, you know, tensions between America and Russia here. We talked about how this is all happening right on their border in a way that previous presidents would not have dared to bring it to this degree, the way Bush and his Bush Jr. and his successors have. So, but, you know, anyway, the question is, how much danger are we really in here of this thing getting completely out of control and turning into a real war between Russia and NATO?
Well, I suppose that danger always existed from the moment the first shot was fired, but I don't think it's as great now as it was 6 weeks ago, and I'll explain why. First of all, I think people have realized that, you know, Russia's military establishment was designed to defend Russia. In other words, the force that you're dealing with right now was never designed to attack NATO. In fact, you know, the Swedish foreign minister, defense ministers, same thing in Finland, they've all said, look, we want to join NATO, but we don't fear an imminent attack from Russia. Right, there are not enough Russian forces to launch a serious offensive against the West. So that's the first thing needs to be understood. That was never going to happen on the high-end conventional level. Secondly, I think people have now discovered that we, on the other hand, have harbored this enormous hostility towards Russia because of its unwillingness to become part of what we think is the global financial system dominated and run by us. And Putin's unwillingness to sort of subordinate himself to the Western banking system and cartels has made him enemy number one on the list, probably with Xi a close second, because those countries stand outside this U.S.-dominated financial system. And if you look carefully at the comments made by Putin, Xi, and now the comments coming out of India, in all of those countries, people are talking about getting out from under the dollar domination. And that really means that they're not going to be dictated to by the World Bank or the IMF, both of which are really instruments of U.S. power, regarding what they grow, what they do, what they don't, what they build, what they don't. Mm-hmm. All of this is bound up with the larger issue. But at the same time, I think there were also people that said this is another good way to strengthen NATO. We'll force cohesion on NATO by perpetuating this conflict with Russia. It's a dumb idea, but then again, I listened to dumb ideas in the 90s when I think, I can't remember if it was Udall or one of the senators said, either we get NATO out of area, in other words, working with us in remote places, or NATO's out of business. Mm-hmm. Well, I, back in 1993, 94, 95, privately felt strongly that NATO probably should go out of business, at least as far as we were concerned. But everyone in Washington was desperate to keep this imperial structure, which is really what it is, with all these dependent states intact. I think that was on the backs of people's minds. The interesting part, though, Scott, is that the people said that they wanted to consolidate NATO and impart cohesion to it and the most successful alliance ever in human history and all this business, they're tearing it apart right now because they finally created this monster that nobody in Europe wants, which is a war between Russia and us.
Yeah.
And the average European, even if he doesn't like Russians, is not interested in that. So it's kind of interesting that one of the underlying purposes of this, which is to strengthen, expand, and make more powerful NATO, it's actually having the opposite effect.
Yep. No surprise there. Now, did you see this? Putin, I don't know if he's really sick like they say. Doug, he must have something because he was on some kind of muscle relaxers or something. And he said, hey, I don't care if Sweden and Finland join NATO. You know why? We don't have any problems with them. They're great. We don't have in that whole long border with Finland. We don't have a single dispute about that line with them. Never will either. No problem. It's all good. Which I was just amazed that he would say that in the middle of this war And I do think maybe he was on some pills because he did kind of sound like a hippie when he said it. It was a bit uncharacteristic. Not that I speak Russian or understand it, but
he's telling you the truth. Russia and Finland have had good relations for decades. The Finns have a long history with Russians, some of which is not very good. But then again, they've had a long history with the Swedes that hasn't always been very good either. But the bottom line is both the Swedish and Finnish governments have said they see no imminent threat from Russia. There isn't one. Remember, the Swedish ambassador just a few weeks ago said, oh, this is wonderful. If we join NATO, we're currently investing 4% of our gross national product in defense. If we join NATO, we can cut that to 2%.
Oh, man, he said that in front of a hot microphone. My God.
Yes, she's a very lovely woman, and she's the ambassador to the United States from Sweden. She's telling you the truth.
Doug Bandow, everybody, call your office.
Everybody is happy to make themselves dependent upon us, provided, of course, we don't drag them into a war in Europe that they don't want. Remember, from the European standpoint, NATO's principal purpose in terms of keeping it was very different from ours. They saw NATO, because I lived through this in the 90s and in the early part of the century, they always saw NATO as preventing another war in Europe. We were the ones that intervened militarily with air power in Bosnia-Herzegovina and then subsequently in Kosovo. Mm-hmm. And frankly, behind closed doors, most Europeans were horrified that we were dragging them into a conflict with another European state. In the case of Kosovo, it was obviously Serbia.
Yeah.
So again, this is the differences in perception. We see NATO as this extension of our interests in this sort of global imperium that we've built. The Europeans don't see it that way. But the problem they have is that they haven't been spending any money on their own defense, and they don't like to cooperate with each other to defend themselves. You know, Europe is probably one of the most interesting places in the world, but it's also incredibly diverse. Mm-hmm. This is why, you know, when people say diversity is our strength, take one look at Europe. No, it's not. It never has been.
Well, you know, and I mean,
wants to be ruled by anybody else.
Yeah, I mean, this is the primary argument, I think, in Europe and in America for American military dominance in Europe is we're not colonizing you. We're just your friends. But we are going to hold down all those little differences between all the little Slovakias and Slovenias around, and because everyone's going to be answerable to our centralized military structure, and that's better than any alternative. Because if it was under the Germans, everyone would be too afraid to submit to Germany. Or if it was under, you know, even a European army with them and France dominating it together, something like that. So I'm not taking that side, believe me. But I'm just saying that would be the number one argument at the National Review, I guess, for keeping NATO is just what you say, that Europe would tear itself apart again if we did.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it will, but I think what you'll see are regions that develop their own solutions. I mean, there are groups of people in Europe that will more readily cooperate with each other than others. The view of the world strategically in Rome or Madrid is very different from the view of the world strategically through the eyes of people in Berlin or Oslo or London. So you have to accept that fact. These powers do not all see things the same way. They never have. You know, when I got to SHAPE headquarters in November of 1998, I asked somebody, what's the story now? You know, Russia is not an enemy. Russia is sort of slipped into irrelevance strategically for us. So what's NATO's purpose? And jokingly, someone said to me, well, with the Soviet Union gone, Europeans have only one natural enemy, France, because the one thing all the Europeans could agree on is that they detest and dislike the French. I mean, it was a joke, obviously, but that's the kind of mentality. Remember, people didn't particularly care for Napoleon to rule the world either.
Right.
Again, Europe has got to do what it's got to do. They've got to sort through these things on their own. And the notion that they should be a tributary set of states to the United States is not a very healthy thing.
Yeah, sure not. And you can ask the Ukrainians about that now. And I'm sorry, because I really could do this all day, but I can't. Do this all day. I gotta go. But thank you so much for your time again on the show, Doug.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it.
All right, you guys, that is Colonel Douglas McGregor. When the Lies Come Home is this latest piece at the American Conservative.
The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., APSradio.com, Antiwar.com, ScottHorton.org, and LibertarianInstitute.org.
Come gather around, people, wherever you advertise, and admit that the 60 sells Chrysler's and fries, and accept it that money don't talk, but it lies. If your bottom line is worth saving, then you better start skimming all anthems we've known for the stocks they are exchanging.
Something happening here. What it is an ad for a beer. I guess you'd say, what can make me feel this way? My beer, talking about my beer. Songs that sell soap and sell cars and sell lifestyles, anthems of freedom now, corporate Sieg Heils. Songs that bring back all those sweet memories, thanks Mitsubishi and who needs trees? When I'm downsized, lost my health care, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite songs and then I don't feel so bad about ads and my culture they're taking. Bad about products that didn't need making. Bad that they're buying the soul of my youth to sell me their shit. Well, it's slightly uncouth. When I'm lonesome or nostalgic, feel I'm gonna cry, I simply remember my favorite songs and then I break down and buy.
Going up the country where man can be free. I'm going up the country where man can be free. I'm going to some place where there's no goddamn Pepsi.
And that was another Dave Lippmann song entitled My Favorite Songs. And because I'm running out of time, I'm going to be playing a couple of long segments. So here's a song to tide you over in case you find yourself getting weary and longing for a musical break. Kind of carry this one with you. It's called Teenage Immigrant Welfare Mothers on Drugs.
It's been 5 years since I've had a raise in pay. Way things are going, I could get laid off any day. Sure is hard living with all this pain. I know what I need. I need somebody to blame. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
My neighborhood library is about to close. The school my kids go to is becoming a joke. Self-serving liberals blame it on corporate tax breaks. But that's propaganda. I know who I should hate. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
Who's to blame for the pot?
potholes and flooding and drought.
It's all their fault, it's all their fault.
Who's to blame for inflation, unemployment, and everything I'm pissed off about? Who's to blame for the end of the good old days? Who's to blame for the fact that I can't get laid? Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back. Send them back. Send them back.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
And that was Teenage Immigrant Welfare Mothers on Drugs. And now I'm going to do a replay of something that was played on, I guess it was yesterday, Wednesday, maybe it was Tuesday, actually, on K-Squid, interview by broadcaster and former council member Chris Crone, interviewing Keith McHenry and Alicia Kuhl. And we're going to play this one straight through. It's about half an hour long, but Keith liked the interview, and I liked what little I heard of it. You get to hear most of it, and hopefully you'll get something from it, too.